From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I've been undertaking more native plant-focused garden transformations in recent years, as I know many of you listening have too. Today's guest is a naturalist with a background in landscape architecture who's been making wildish gardens for decades, both at home and in his public garden career. Alan Brownhagen is here to talk about some of his own native plant adventures and to highlight some native annuals for us that can play various key roles in our gardens as they do at his place too. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook Small Gift Books illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
Alan Brownhagen, a lifelong naturalist with a background in landscape architecture, is director of operations at the 1,200-acre Minnesota Landscape Arboretum in suburban Minneapolis. He's the former director of horticulture at Powell Gardens in Kansas City and the author of two books on Midwestern native plants. Hi, Alan. I'm so glad to get to do this today. Thank you.
Good morning, Margaret. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So before we start, I want to do a book giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. And since it's part of a series, you've done two books. I think 2015 was Native Plants of the Midwest, which is a comprehensive guide to the best 500 species for the garden. And that's one. And then the newer one is part of a series, the Midwest Native Plant Primer. Is part of a series that also has a Southeast and a Northeast and a Midwest edition. So I thought that'd be a good one to give away because depending on who wins, maybe I could give them one for their region.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. But congratulations on books. And you're a busy guy. so we got to know each other recently because we worked on a New York Times garden column together, which was fun. And I loved the story you told me when we were working on it about one of your first sort of aha moments about native annuals. Because like, really, how many of us, quick test, everybody listening, can name any native annuals? Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I was working for, well, I think it was Nature Conservancy funded, working for the Iowa Department of Conservation, actually doing bird surveys. And in between, you know, you have to do those early in the morning, and then we'd go visit all these natural areas. And it was a Lust Bluff prairie in western Iowa. And I'm like, oh my gosh, here is snow on the mountain growing on this prairie. And I don't, you know, of course I'd known that plant as a lifelong gardener, even though I was probably, you know, 20 at the time, or even maybe in my teens. But I mean, that was that aha moment. And I looked, yes, it is, it is a native plant. And of course it is one that I did cover in my book.
And so it's a euphorbia. And it's very dramatically variegated. So people have seen it probably in seed catalogs and so forth. What is it? Euphorbia marginata. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marginata.
Yeah. And so there are native annuals. And yet, again, if we did a quick quiz, I mean, I couldn't, off the top of my head, I had trouble when I first thought about it, really naming many of them from my area. And a little later in the show, we'll tell people how to find the ones for their area. I've got some tips for that. But you also told me about a book that was published, I think, in 1976, which has the craziest title ever, a book by Hal Bruce, How to Grow Wildflowers and Wild Shrubs and Trees in Your Own Garden. That
yes.
was inspirational to you, title notwithstanding.
That's right. One of my teachers lent me that book, and I read through it, and it was just so inspiring to me. And I quickly started planting more native plants in my yard and actually took out some of the non-native or invasive ones. And so this is way back when I was a teenager. I was 14 then, so 1976
right.
when that came out.
Right. Right. So so you've been really doing these experiments that, as I was mentioning, I've been doing more and more myself. And I did some early on, you know, decades ago, but more and more the last 10 years, especially as I think a lot of people are. So like, tell us, just, you sent me a picture the other day, a snapshot of your house. I think it might've been the front yard, and
yes,
where there was, well, where one would normally expect a lawn, there was like echinacea and fleabane. And I mean, it was like, whoa. So tell us just a little bit about the garden where you are now, that where your home landscape, what that looks like compared to an average landscape.
Yes, I absolutely do walk the talk. So yes, I bought my house 5 years ago when I moved here to Minnesota to accept my job here. And I bought a home in a traditional landscape, at least the front yard. The backyard does bump up against a forested corridor, which is really nice. But the front yard was just a traditional landscape, and actually a fairly large front yard. I mean, there were yews and daylilies and irrigated turf grass. So the very first thing I did was rip out the daylilies. I did keep a couple of the yews by the house, but I wanted to and it faces the southwest slope, a very hot southwest slope of really well-drained soil. And I quickly designed some beds that are really prairie themed to go in that area. And it has been a smashing success, as I shared with you. So I didn't do the typical matrix planting. I kind of planted key structural plants and then kind of let some things self-sow. And, you know, that leads into, you know, you mentioned the daisy fleabane that showed up. And that's one of those annuals that I think, you know, most gardeners are going to run into that plant. It's just going to come up in wherever they disturb the soil. And of course, I leave that because it just adds such a great splash of contrasting white color. Is great for pollinators, and you know, it can be a little rambunctious, so I edit it a little bit where I don't want it, but you know, it's one of those that you really want to celebrate.
So you said matrix planting. Now just tell me quickly, what, you didn't do that, and what is that sort of?
Well, that's really popular right now, where you don't use a lot of mulch. You know, you plant structural plants, big long-lived things like Baptisia that everyone knows.
Yeah.
And then you put in seasonal color plants that have like a seasonal 2-week bloom period in between that. And then ground cover, and the hot ground cover right now is sedges, to actually really act as your living mulch. And, you know, it is a really good way to do a small garden setup, but it can be kind of pricey. And that was,
yes,
my reason. It's like I had to work a little more overtime with nature. So,
right. Okay. So we could do the matrix thing, especially if we were making a bed. We have these sort of three primary elements, the sort of permanent big guys, the in-betweens that do some filler work, and then the ground cover layer. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and the annuals fit in that seasonal color. And I actually did do a little play with that. And, you know, I know we're going to talk a little bit about some of the non-local native ones that I do use for that.
I know, we can't control ourselves. but so speaking of sort of placeholders, so here you are, you had this lawn, and, you know, irrigated lawn on top of it, you know, and that was going to go, and you started to put in the new things, but the new things don't all, especially perennial things, don't take hold quickly and fill in quickly. So speaking of the annuals that could be sort of nurse crop / cover crop / fillers, temporary companions. So what are some of the ones that you have used either there at home or in your work?
Yeah, black-eyed Susans is really a classic one that I first started using 35 years ago when I worked at the Forest Preserve District. We would, you know, restoring prairies, large areas, you know, it would show to the public that you're actually doing something, because the first season it'll come up and bloom and act as a nurse crop for the longer-lived perennials that are coming in underneath.
Huh.
And then, of course, another really good one is partridge pea, Camicrista fasciculata, and it, you know, it really comes into bloom in late summer. Those beautiful yellow flowers that are buzz pollinated by bees. I mean, it will be an audible experience besides a visual one, because it attracts so many bees. And again, since it's buzz pollinated, they're actually, you know, shaking the flower to get the pollen, and you can hear it.
And that one was featured, speaking of the series of primers that you did the Midwest volume of. In the eastern one, the northeastern one, that plant was also used, recommended for that use there. So it's mm-hmm. a widespread, has utilitarian uses in a widespread area of the country, that partridge pea. Yeah.
And of course, I still have both of those plants in my current landscape. You know, I gave up on my kitchen garden because of deer and rabbits, and I converted to pollinator landscape, and that's what I used to help nurse that along. And of course, it's already went to the other level of succession. And I think I even shared a picture of, you know, the partridge pea is in between the crack of my front walk and my front step of my front porch.
Yeah.
Kind of a nice little greeting plant along there. And then I just edit what I don't want.
So you have probably less of them than when they were being actively used as a nurse crop for the stuff to come later that was taking time to develop, but you still have elements of them.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And I think you told me about a Monarda, a bee balm relative that I'd never heard of before.
Right. At when we, Paul Gardens, again, I started working there 25 years ago. And one of my first projects was creating this large parking lot landscape where we, again, restored a grassland community there. And we used black-eyed Susans, but we also used a couple more Southwestern Midwest natives there. Yeah, the lemon bergamot, Monarda citriodora. And then, the Plains Coreopsis, Coreopsis tinctoria, we also used in that mix. And again, they created that first season splash of color. The lemon bergamot, the Monarda, is just a really showy plant and really, really rich in nectar, attracting lots of interesting bees and pollinators. So
a lot of those mint relative things do that. And then some of the other things you've mentioned are composites or sunflower or daisy relatives. And those are also super, I mean, the mint things and the composites are super for pollinators. I mean, so it makes sense that these would do a really good job.
And again, they, you know, faded out over time, except where, you know, maybe woodchuck dug a little hole and then you created disturbance, and then those things would pop up in that spot. So, and of course, that's pretty much their role in nature. They're kind of the earth healers.
Yeah, you call them earth healers. I love that, because where a disturbance occurs from whatever, either as small as you just said, an animal digging a hole, to something much bigger, like a major weather event or whatever, you know, the annuals rush in to sort of take up the space, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe we should now just say to people, these aren't all going to be native where everyone listening gardens and so forth. And it's going to take some homework. Like we said in the New York Times story together, you know, it's going to take some homework. If you really want to find ones that are native to your zone, I found that the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower website, wildflower.org, that they have this page of what they call collections. And we can give a link in the transcript of the show, but then you can go there and it's like collections of different, you can filter for your state, check the box for your state. And then when you get there, you can then check another box for the lifespan of the plants you're looking for. Like if you're looking for perennials, it can filter for perennials, biennials, or annuals. So you can check annuals. And it's amazing. You get a list of, like, you know, the best native annuals for your state. I mean, again, it's not totally hyper-local, but that's pretty close. Or you could go to your state Wildflower Society website. Some of those have plant lists too. So, I mean, all the things we're speaking about are not going to be for everybody, is what we're saying. But some of us use ones that are from other parts of the country too. So tell us about some of those, like you and your California poppy, right?
I can't be without my California poppies. And then here, they didn't do very well this year because we had such a shockingly dry spring. But on a normal year, they are really an important component to my front yard landscape. And right as the last snows are melting in spring, I sprinkle the seeds out, usually, you know, in the bare areas along the edges of the beds or whatever, in between plantings. And of course, they, you know, are cool season annuals and come up and, you know, bloom in early summer, and they just are so stunning. The other one is a California bluebell, Phacelia campanulata. I just wouldn't be without. I mean, once you've seen that in bloom and how incredibly gorgeous blue that is, That's another one. And of course, it makes a great companion with the brilliant orange California poppies. So,
and do you sow that the same way? Do you do that?
Yeah, same time. Yeah, these are, people get this idea, don't plant stuff till after danger of frost. Well, you'll fail on these cool season annuals. You need to get them in early. And one of the best ways, if you have snow in your area, is, let it go in with the snow, because it I think that helps, the last freeze and thaw cycles help it get into the soil just the right way so that you get the germination.
What zone are you where you are? You're near Minneapolis. Yeah,
we used to be zone 4, but really the core metro, and actually where my garden is zone 5 now. I can readily grow zone 5 things now, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are two that are from California, as their names seem to tell us. I have, and here I'm in New York State, and I have this obsession with one that is from, I think, like Texas and maybe parts of Florida, and I don't know, a couple other spots. The silverleaf sunflower, I don't know if you've ever grown it. I think it's Helianthus argyphyllus or something, argyphyllus, I think is how you spell it. And it's this big plant, it's just gorgeous, and it's furry and silvery all over. And then it just produces these like candelabras of flowers, of gold flowers, it's wonderful. And the great thing is that with that one, like Southern Exposure Seed Exchange has been selling the seed, and Annie's Annuals for years has been selling young plants of it. You can get by mail order. So some of these are available, and some take, again, a little more homework to find.
Yep. You try it now.
The what one?
The silverleaf sunflower.
Oh boy. It's a stunner. It's eccentric. It's not symmetrical, right? Right. Another native annual, widespread, I think, nowadays is just the American sunflower, right? The annual sunflower, Helianthus annuus. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way that the species of that is like, it's not this one stalk with one big head. It's like this crazy thing, right?
Yep. Multiple flowers, but stunning. Yep. State flower of Kansas.
Right, exactly. And so are there others that you're using that are from areas way outside the Midwest?
Well, the Gallardia pulchella is another one that I let. It seems to self-sow in bare spaces between, but for the hottest part of summer, those brilliant red flowers with the yellow edging are just absolutely stunning. And of course, one of my absolute favorites, and anyone who tries it is going to be sold with it, is American Basket Flower, Centaurea americana, our native bachelor button.
Oh, right.
It is a wow. And, Seed Savers in my hometown, Decorah, Iowa, sold it this year. I was so thrilled. And what a great plant. That one doesn't come back very well for me, so I usually have to start a few in late winter, early spring, and then I put them in little peat pots and then set them where I want them. But the flowers are like 4 inches across and lavender, though there is a white form of it. And once you see the bumblebees and the sweat bees and the monarch butterflies and all the things that are enjoying that, you'll be sold on it. And then even when it goes to seed, the goldfinches are feeding on it, and the seed stock holds well through winter and is actually pretty attractive in the winter.
It's interesting. And those flowers are like 4 inches or something. They're kind of furry, almost fuzzy. Select Seeds sells the seed too. So that's one that I've started, like you said, that Seed Savers has it now too. And I'm seeing it sort of come around, being showcased, which is great, is really great. Some just like you mentioned, fleabane, the annual fleabane, Erigeron annuus, that, mm-hmm. Just kind of, if you dig a hole somewhere in much of the country, it's going to show up.
Yep.
And there's other fleabanes too, but that's the annual one that we're talking about. And jewelweed is the same way, the annual, the native impatience, that's pretty widespread. I think those are both in like 40 something states, according to the range maps or something. But The funny thing with those is, like, you don't, there's no seed sources for them. Do you know what I mean? It's you can't really buy seed. Now in England, you can buy seed for annual fleabane, our annual fleabane.
Yes, they gush over it. Yes.
They think it's gorgeous, right? So, yep. So there you go, folks. There's the validation that it's a great plant, right?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So what, everyone just pulls these things out, right? They see jewelweed, they're like, oh my goodness, it's going to take over the whole yard. I'm getting rid of it. It's, you know, kind of in a moist, shady or semi-shady space. What do you tell us that you think, with the experience you have of all these years?
Yeah.
What do you do? What's the hand that you take to that plant or to fleabane?
Well, I edit, but I wouldn't be without. I mean, the jewelweeds are just so much fun, and especially, well, children and adults, you know, enjoying. The other name of it is touch me not, because when the seeds are getting close to ripe, or the fruits are getting close to ripe, you touch it and of course it explodes, which is always a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then the little seeds inside there, they're actually edible, and they, you can, if you scratch the surface of them, they're just this gorgeous robin eggs blue underneath and have this oil of wintergreen aroma to them. But the flowers themselves, I mean, it's like spotted jewelweed, capensis, impatiens capensis, is just one of the favorite nectar sources of our ruby-throated hummingbird here in the East. And, you know, they, if you have a nice patch of it, a hummingbird will guard it just like a hummingbird feeder. So, but yeah, it can be overly rambunctious. So yeah, we do edit them here and make sure that they don't encroach on any other special plants.
I've picked two spots. They come up everywhere here, mm-hmm. and mice, I think, move the seeds around and who knows what, but I have picked two spots that are like, I'm going to let a stand of them happen. Big spots, you know, because I have a couple, like you, my place is almost the same size as yours, a little over 2 acres. And mm-hmm. so, you know, and I've identified those and I feel okay about editing them elsewhere, mm-hmm. but I've, you know, so there's two good stands of them. And so that's the orange one, capensis. And then there's the yellow one sometimes in some places, more eastern places too.
Yeah, impatiens pallida, which has, it's more, at least in my area, it's more, I see the bumblebees using it.
Right.
But, and it's usually more in a mesic forest, a moist forest, rather. The capensis is usually more wetter areas in our local area.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we hear it's pretty widespread, but it's always, the soil has to have some moisture to it, not mm-hmm. wet, but you know what I mean? It can't be baking either.
Right.
And it's shady, usually shady. So we have a few minutes left, you know, and I want to just talk about some that you wish people knew more. I mean, some that you talked about to me, Palifoxia, Collinsia, a crazy Eryngium. You know, I didn't even know these. I'd never heard the genus name, let alone seen the plants. So right. Tell me about some of those.
Well, Collinsia verna is the blue-eyed Mary, and it's a winter annual. So it actually comes up in the fall and blooms in the spring, and then it's gone. But oh my gosh, if you've ever experienced it in the wild, when you get big patches of it, usually in kind of mesic floodplain forests, and it was both found in where I worked in Illinois and in Missouri, it is just delightful. The only place I've seen it really successful in a garden is at the English Woodland Garden at Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. So that's one I think people really, really, really should look at. And then Palifoxia, I ran into that in Missouri because it's mainly an Ozark native, and we use it in our living wall, our kind of rock garden display, and it would just self-sow. And it's like this pink baby's breath. It just is a phenomenal annual. And I know it's naturalized even like into northern Indiana and so on. So it must do well over a wide area. I haven't tried it yet in Minnesota, though I plan to, but it is, and you know, it loves it hot and dry. And then, oh my gosh, if you ever see the Leavenworth's Eryngium Leavenworthii from, it's kind of on the west side of Kansas City and south into the Great Plains. They look like these stunning purple pineapples, the flowers do.
Right.
And it's one of those that if you have the hottest, driest hell strip spot that you think nothing will grow, that plant will love it. At Powell Gardens, the only place it would really self-sow was in a gravel space between the greenhouses, but another plant that, yeah, please try it but you have to have, you know, full intense sun and you know, a hot spot for
the Palifoxia and the Collinsia. So the blue-eyed Mary and the Palifoxia, I saw that Missouri Wildflowers, yes. Seed Company. Yeah, mm-hmm. You know them, I guess, huh?
Yes, they sell all kinds of Missouri original native plants, but they will send you the seeds of those.
Yeah, so that was a great source for, you know, because I went after you turned me on to some of these things and I was reading about them. I looked for sources and sure enough, they had a lot and I didn't know that nursery. So that was great. That was, and I'll give the links again with the transcript, sure. And so forth. So in the last minute or so, just what other things besides that great looking front yard, which we'll show a picture of with the transcript, hopefully. What other crazy things are you doing over there?
Well, let me see. I guess more of the same. We want to get rid of this drought that we're stuck
yeah,
in.
Yeah, you guys are really, and every time I complain about no rain here, I think of you and people elsewhere in the country who are in true depths of drought. And you know, yeah, it's unbelievable.
If you want to cover one last plant, of course, the plain sneezeweed, Helenium amarum, another really great little ferny one that is especially good for the edges of beds or against paths and you know, sidewalks. It's another one that will self-sow. So
yeah, it is. It's beautiful. Beautiful foliage too. So what we'll do is, as I said, I'll give lots of links, also to remind people that they can do the homework and find the ones for their region or try ones from other regions too, like we crazy people are always doing. But thank you so much, Alan. I'm so glad that we've met and I hope we'll do more things together. So much appreciation and I hope it rains.
Thank you, Margaret.
All right. Talk to you soon again, I hope.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbooks, Small Gift Books, illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now. Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, I hope, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.